You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, August 9th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, publisher of the Black Star News, author of Manufacturing Hate, How Africa Was Demonized in Western Media, Milton Alamadi will be here to talk about that book and understanding the Ethiopia-Tigray conflict. Meanwhile, the UN-IPCC report, the Earth is warming at a significantly faster rate than previously thought. In other horrible news, U.S. now averaging 100,000 COVID infections per day, and deaths are rising too. Delta variant now accounts for 94% of all new infections. The FDA is fast-tracking a third dose for immunocompromised. Supreme Court hears Indiana University students' case to try and block the university's vaccine mandate. The Portman Cinema so-called bipartisan infrastructure deal on track for passage this week. Schumer vows the same for the reconciliation bill. Joe Biden extends the student loan repayment pause into 2022. Cuomo's top aide resigns as he scrambles to avoid impeachment. Taliban seize their first provincial capital since the withdrawal announcement. And facing a massive unemployment insurance cliff in less than 30 days, Joe Manchin says, I don't care. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us this week. Joining me, as always, is Emma Vigeland. Hello, Emma. How are
you? Hello, Sam. I'm well.
I got to tell you, I am feeling, increasingly anxious. I mean, about what's happening with the Delta variant. Just about 2 or 3 weeks ago, I spoke with David Wallace Wells for the show Reported that we do on Peacock as well. And he had written a piece that the children were safe all along, and that the children were just simply not that susceptible to the wild type COVID. And there had been really no data just 3 weeks ago regarding the Delta variant. But this variant is significantly more transmittable, it moves quicker, and the initial reports were that the vaccines were protecting people somewhat from breakthrough infections, but very largely against hospitalization and death. And it still appears that it does it for death. It is less clear, what's happening in terms of hospitalizations. But we are seeing a commensurate rise in hospitalizations and deaths that is not necessarily the same ratio that we saw back in the peak during January. But we also don't have the same amount of testing going on. And so it's hard to it's really hard to know what's going on. This thing is moving so quickly, the Delta variant.
People are less likely to get tested when they're vaccinated.
Much less likely.
So,
there's less opportunities, too. I mean, I know just, you know, around Brooklyn, like the places where I would get tested, they're like, well, we closed that one because it wasn't, there's nobody getting tests. And now they're all starting to get booked up again. And it's tricky. People have got to be careful. And people are less, you know, not wearing masks as much. And it's a problem.
Yeah. And the places that are getting hit the hardest are obviously the places with the lowest vaccination rates. I mean, the fact that only 35%, I think that's the figure I wrote down here. Yeah. 35% of people in Alabama and Mississippi, residents who are eligible, are fully vaccinated. With this Delta variant, I mean, we're going to see an exponential increase in deaths. We're already up to over 500 on a rolling average. And there was this insane Wall Street Journal piece that came out yesterday. And they profiled people who were vaccine hesitant, including this one woman named Shonda Parrish. She's a nurse. She has cancer. Her father and stepmother died of COVID. And she's a nurse. I'm repeating that. So she's, you know, literate when it comes to medical information, refuses to get vaccinated.
She's also presumably working with around sick people.
Yeah.
Who might be a little more susceptible. It's stunning. And we should also say that, you know, we have 70% vaccination rate amongst adults in this country, but it is not fully vaccinated. I think we're still like just hovering around, maybe not even quite 50% fully vaccinated yet. And so it's really, it's scary. People have got to just be careful for their sake, for the rest of society's sake. And meanwhile, you know, you got Ron DeSantis down there in Florida, just like pretending like none of this is happening. It's really stunning. And Florida now represents 20% of all cases in the country. And again, this thing's moving so fast. When you look at a 14-day average, I would suspect that at one point, the epidemiologists or whomever it is who look at these, you know, who set up these metrics, that it makes more sense to look at a 14-day average to get a sense of what the trend is. They may at one point say, this thing moves so much faster. You only have 3 or 4 days for it to incubate, as opposed to like, 5 to 11 or whatever it was in the wild type. This thing incubates so much faster that...
And multiplies so much faster.
That you may have a more accurate... And I don't know. I'm not a statistician. But... that you may have a more accurate picture of what's actually happening with a narrower window, because you're actually, like, you know, 14-day trailing has a, you know, significantly distorting of impact on where this is headed going forward. But we'll see. But folks should just, you know, be conscious and be careful out there. The idea of masking, and particularly, you know, if you can get a KN95 mask, you're going into a crowded place. We're already starting to think about what are we going to do about the office here, but I think we're all pretty good about masking up in other environments, but still, it's something to start to think about so that we can avoid, around, I don't know, where are we, like 6 of this? 5? 4? I have no idea.
In terms of
yes, how many
round?
Times have we been going through? Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. I mean, speaking of rounds, I feel like I've been punched in the face multiple times by this, like, virus. So I just, like, I'm luckier than most, but it's just
is
idea
that... worker virus?
Yeah. The idea that we're dealing with, I mean...
Yeah, I know.
And the longer that this goes on, people keep saying, you know, I'm seeing when I'm bemoaning people who are unvaccinated or like, you know, I don't even know what to say to get these... we're trying to convince people. People are like, oh, you know, Darwinism. Nah, it affects you too, because the longer this is out in the ether, the more it's going to metastasize and become even worse than the Delta variant.
There's a lot more letters in the Greek alphabet.
than Delta?
Yeah.
Good to know.
Yep. So keep that in mind, folks. Meanwhile, the latest reporting, and we heard this just about an hour ago, is that it appears that Schumer thinks he's going to be able to vote on this Sinema Portman infrastructure bill within like 24 hours.
Right.
There, and this is, I don't know, the one of the saddest statements we could ever make about anything. I don't know if it's just human nature or American politics or what, or this era, or, but they really want to get on to vacation. So it is creating a lot of incentive for them to just vote on this combined, you know,
the glory of our democracy.
I mean, if we could get between Kristen Sinema and her wine, I think we might have some real leverage here.
$4 trillion worth of spending.
She's got a wine tasting to get to. Let's go.
I mean, honestly, I guess whatever it takes, but it is just an incredible, it's an incredible dynamic. The other dynamic, which I've been talking about for a while, is that Democrats, and are there, you know, deficiencies? And of course, but they're trying to pass $4 trillion of new spending that are going to have structural implications for our economy and universal pre-K, free community college. I mean, we just go on and on here. A child allowance that will last at least 5 years and be hard to roll back. All of these things. And there's much more. And it certainly will be the biggest expenditure of federal expenditure in terms of like programs since I think like Medicare. And then the Republicans are really worried about critical race theory being taught to kindergartners.
Ah, you know, one side says this, the other side says this, and it's hard to determine who's correct, right?
What's fascinating is let's take a dip into that world. Mm. Here is Senator Bill Cassidy, and he's on with Fox White House correspondent Jackie Heinrich. And here's Bill Cassidy lamenting the fact that he belongs to the Republican Party in some way.
Down the MAGA rabbit hole we go.
Structure.
Now, you also had to clear up some misinformation about critical race theory in this bill. You said on Twitter that equity is not a catchphrase for CRT. Were you surprised you had to address that? And what does it say about how far apart the two parties are?
No, I will say that people are deliberately misrepresenting the bill. There is one single line, or maybe two, maybe three, in this bill, which says that if you take a grant from the federal government, you cannot discriminate. And then it plugs in anti-discrimination language, which is already in federal law. Okay, so I get a grant. I'm supposed to make sure everybody has access to the internet. Should I be allowed to discriminate? Of course not. It has nothing to do with CRT. It is something put out there, misinformation by those who should know better, in an effort to decrease support for bridges, roads, flood protection, coastal restoration, and hundreds of thousands of jobs. I don't know why they're doing it.
So at this stage,
you don't know why they're doing it?
Well, I mean, who are those people that should know better?
That's the thing, is these anti-CRT people, if they were honest about it, they would say, yes, you should be able to discriminate.
Well, that's the other thing.
Right.
That's the other thing. He thinks he's out of the hot water. Like, I mean, it's already, and this is just, it's fascinating. I mean, there is a fascinating dynamic here in that, and I don't know who, you know, who's watching, you know, Fox Weekend. I mean, I'd like to see him go on, you know, on Tucker. And
although
say
we
that,
did see him go on Laura Ingraham.
Right. And get screamed
testy.
Down.
Yeah.
The Republican Party, their base, does not like their politicians. There's no judgment on my part here. This is a dynamic that people should understand. This guy's going to pass an infrastructure bill, the benefits of which are largely going to accrue to his constituents and to Republican constituents as well. I mean, also Democratic constituents.
But well, they didn't like their politicians until one guy came around.
Well, that's true. But the point being, that Democrats, for better or for worse, generally like their politicians. And we saw this play out in Ohio to some extent with Nina Turner's loss. I think probably Democrats subscribe to her vision of what America would be like. We know this from the polling in terms of Medicare for All and other proposals, but they just have an affinity for 90% of Democrats support Joe Biden. The Schumer and Pelosi, as much as it may frustrate us, and I don't necessarily share this perspective, I don't, they're like 40% approval rating. Positive approval rating.
40 plus.
40 plus, yeah. In terms of like they're favorable to unfavorable.
Right.
And so this is a dynamic that those of us who are to the left of the center of the Democratic Party need to be aware of. But it's also fascinating in terms of the Republicans. Like, they're going to pay for passing this infrastructure bill. And they are caught between a rock and a hard place because they cannot appeal to those voters that they lost or have sort of drifted for them because of Donald Trump. And also their base, just in voting for like for an infrastructure bill. This is not a controversial thing.
Right. Well, I mean, so that's the split. The Republicans within, they're fine eating each other, I guess, and ripping each other limb from limb in the Republican caucus as long as they can get some brownie points on critical race theory. See, you know, whoever the most MAGA senator is fine with throwing Cassidy under the bus because his bipartisan infrastructure framework includes the word equity or equality, and then
just a reiteration of what's already in federal law. You cannot discriminate.
Yeah,
but if you're getting governmental grants.
Right, but it secretly means critical race theory. So look at me. I'm the guy that's looking out for you, and I'm the one who's not going to be in favor of indoctrinating your children through infrastructure, ? Don't worry, they'll stay pure and white. And so that's the game that they play. They're fine with that because they have a larger project in mind. And they'll just shuffle in, if Cassidy's out, some other corporate drone who can do the bidding of their donors in the Republican Party and the conservative project. It's a different dynamic.
Should be interesting to see. And if I'm the Democratic Party, as soon as this bill passes, I tout the equity in it. That's what I do.
Yeah.
Down in Louisiana. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Milton Alamati. He's the publisher of the Black Star News and the author of Manufacturing Hate, How Africa Was Demonized in Western Media. Be right back after this moment. A couple of sponsors today.
Whoa.
One is, folks know I am a little bit challenged when it comes to dressing and myself, and certainly shopping for my own clothes is also somewhat problematic. One of my solutions, Stitch Fix. Much easier to let Stitch Fix do the hard work. Stitch Fix offers clothing that is hand-selected by expert stylists for your unique style, size, and budget.
Styes.
Your styes?
My styes.
I try and combine it together.
No,
style, just, like some people like things that are too big for them. That's your styes.
Thinking about my eye issue last week.
Every piece is chosen to fit you and your life so you can look and feel your best. And here's the thing. You try your pieces on at home. And you do so before you buy. You keep the ones that you love. You return the ones that you don't. Stitch Fix has free shipping and easy returns or exchanges. They put a prepaid return envelope included in your initial package. There's no subscription required. You pay just a $20 styling fee for each box, which gets credited towards pieces you keep. There are no hidden fees ever. Stitch Fix has styles and clothing to fit any occasion for women, kids, and men. They ship all over the U.S., available in the U.K. as well. The last Stitch Fix I got had two things in it that I was looking at specifically. One was a gray polo, because I was like, hey, I should mix it up on Fridays, mm-hmm. Not just blue polo all the time. Get a gray polo. And then the other one was a blue Riley Searsucker short sleeve shirt. They both showed up. I didn't like the gray polo. It was like the colors were a little bit different than I thought it was. But then, surprise, I love the Searsucker shirt. I think it was...
you wore it the other day, I think.
I did. Yeah. Brendan said it was slimming on me. And that was enough for me to say, like, I'm keeping this.
I sent back that gray polo that you returned.
I sent it back, but it was so easy. That was the thing that was amazing about it. And then they have a sense at this point of what my style is. They recommended, I'm still waiting on this, but it's not really something I'm going to need until the fall. It is a method baseball style sweater. Zipper sweater style.
Okay.
I'm looking forward to that. Anyways, you can get started today at stitchfix.com/majority. You get 25% off when you keep everything in your fix. That's what they call the box that they send you with all the styles. That's stitchfix.com/majority for 25% off when you keep everything in your fix. stitchfix.com/majority. And every day, when I do this show, I've got, two things. Two bottles of this. Now, this is one's empty right now because that's already poured into my glass. I've got the other bottle in the fridge. And that is Liquid IV. 16 ounces of water with Liquid IV hydrates faster and more efficiently than water alone. Plus, Liquid IV tastes great. They got flavors like watermelon, which is exactly what's in my cup right now, strawberry and lemon lime. All very summery, but for me, also my go-to every day is the matcha because it gives me a little bit of a caffeine boost and also hydrates me simultaneously. Liquid IV contains 5 essential vitamins, more vitamin C than an orange, as much potassium as a banana, and it's healthier than sugary sports drinks. There's no artificial flavors, no artificial preservatives, less sugar than an apple. Liquid IV is powered by cellular transport technology, gives you an optimal ratio of glucose, sodium, potassium. It delivers water and nutrients into the bloodstream. And the company has donated over 4 million servings in response to COVID-19, which is nice.
Very nice.
It is, if I've had too much to drink, next morning, Liquid IV sets me up.
Or
sometimes,
if you remember.
Yes, I have it at
or
night.
Or if you remember, the key to do it is at night.
Exactly.
Before you sleep.
But it's now just become a staple. I'm like, why not have more hydration every day? And that's what I do during the show. And, you know, start traveling. Super easy to carry with you. If you're going out and about, super easy to keep in your backpack or your little shoulder sling. That's what I do. Grab your Liquid IV in bulk nationwide at Costco, or you can get 25% off when you go to liquidiv.com. Use the promo code MajorityRep at checkout. That's 25% off anything you order when you get better hydration today using promo code MajorityRep. MajorityRep at liquidiv.com. And lastly, another thing that I use almost daily basis. I mean, I don't buy that much stuff, but we all shop online. I tend to do more so than I have in the past. And you know the story. I've told my daughter when she was, you know, first looking at stuff to buy online, always search for a promo code. Mm-hmm. And then one day I said to her, guess what? You don't have to do this anymore. Both of us have Honey on our browser. It's a free shopping tool. Scours the internet for promo codes, applies the best one, and then adds it to your cart. Honey supports over 30,000 stores online, tech sites, gaming products, Matt, popular fashion brands, even food delivery. And this is what happens. Basically, you just go through your shopping. You install the applet to your browser. It takes about 5 seconds. Then you forget about it until you're just at checkout. Honey drops down. It searches coupons. And one of two things happens. A, knocks a couple bucks off. Great. It was no effort whatsoever. Or it tells you there are no coupons. And then you don't have to have that anxiety of like, did I miss out on something? Leave money on the table. That's what I like about
that. Yeah, it also tells you when the price, if the price is lower than it normally is, if it's dipped. I like that tool too.
I bought a beanbag chair recently for Myla's a little birthday soiree that's happening in less than a week, and I saved $5. I didn't have to do anything. It was great. Super easy, because I've saved on tech stuff in the past that we bought around the office, everything. If you don't already have Honey, you could be straight up missing out on free savings. It's literally free and installs in a few seconds. And by getting it, you'll be doing yourself a solid and supporting this podcast. I would never recommend something I don't use. I think folks know that. And I use it every time I purchase something in one fashion or another. Get Honey for free at joinhoney.com/majority. That's joinhoney.com/majority. I should also say happy birthday to my daughter today.
Oh, it's Mel's birthday today?
Yep. Longtime listeners will remember when that took place. All right. Want to welcome to the program Milton Alamotti. He's the publisher of the Black Star News and author of his most recent Manufacturing Hate, How Africa Was Demonized in Western Media. Milton, I'm here with Emma Vigeland. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
So Milton, I want to start with your book, and then I want to have you catch us up on what's going on in Ethiopia. Your book it's fascinating. You went in and, tell us how you started, research, because the start of this book really took place quite a while ago. And it ultimately led to the writing of this book, which essentially talks about how from for decades now, the Western media has been creating this narrative about Africa that has led that perpetuates racism, I guess. But please.
Okay, well, maybe some brief background and context. I was born in Uganda, so I grew up partly in Uganda and in Tanzania. And I started reading newspapers on a regular basis when I was around 12 years old, when I was living in Tanzania at that time. And I noticed Africa and, you know, Black people in general were always depicted in a certain way in Western media. I was reading the New York Times, Time Magazine, Newsweek, and whatever I could get my hands on at the U.S. Information Services. So it's something that bothered me, and I know it bothered many Africans while you're growing up, but there's not much you can do about it. So I didn't really have a chance to do anything till I got to Columbia University. And when I was doing the master's program in I decided to write my thesis on the Times. And I focused on the New York Times because the Times archive goes really way back. One of the earliest writings about Africa I encountered was an editorial from 1877. And basically, it reflected the kind of writings that were popularized by the so-called explorers, Europeans who went to, quote-unquote, discover Africa. And basically, those were agents, of course, of imperialism. They were laying the groundwork. They were doing the research, finding out about each country, what resources they had. And that, of course, ended up with the formal partition of Africa in the last 20 years of the 19th century. So I then wrote my master's paper. I critiqued the coverage, of course, the racist coverage. And I wanted to do something better. I wanted to breathe some life into it. So I contacted the New York Times and I asked if I could be put in touch with reporters. They started sending out to Africa in the 1950s and 1960s. And I think at the time, the librarian, you know, when librarians still existed, told me that maybe it was a better idea to actually go to the New York Times archives and read the correspondences exchanged between the reporters and the editor, the foreign editor here in New York City.
And we should say... you're talking about now, this is early 1990s, right? You're work. Okay. I just want to be.
Yes, this is actually 1992.
Okay.
So I went to the archives and I don't believe that they knew what those files contained in terms of how horrific some of those correspondence were. And so obviously, this is what a reporter wants to find, right? So to me, it was a great gift. So, for example, I found a letter written by Homer Bigart, who is, of course, well-known. He had already won the Pulitzer two times before he joined the Times, when he was with the New York Herald Tribune. And he wrote back to Emmanuel Friedman, who was the foreign news editor. And, of course, I'm paraphrasing. And he's saying, you know, I cannot get enthusiastic about this assignment. And his assignment was to cover decolonization in Africa. He said he wasn't impressed with leaders such as Kwame Nkrumah, who was Ghana's first prime minister after independence from Britain. He said he preferred the primitive bush people because, after all, cannibalism was the best antidote to this population explosion that everybody is complaining about. So then my first impression was, okay, was this like the deranged writings of one reporter, perhaps? So then I went to look at what was published that he wrote from Africa at that time. And there was a perfect correlation between these personal exchanges and what he wrote purportedly as news coverage from Africa. And this was actually promoted and encouraged by the foreign news editor, who in one of his letters to Bigart said, oh, this is just, and I'm of course paraphrasing again, this is just to say hello and to find out how you're doing in the Badlands. I want you to know that by now you're American journalism's expert on African witchcraft, sorcery, and all the other exotic phenomenon indigenous to darkest Africa. Where else can you get this but in the New York Times for a nickel? I believe it was a nickel at that time. And so I completed this paper, and then I was encouraged when it won one of those prizes they give at the end of the semester at Columbia. And I also further encouraged when I was approached by Columbia Journalism Review that wanted to publish it. So I thought, okay, this is the kind of breakthrough I wanted, because this is really the way to push back against this narrative, and maybe this will improve the prospects of this getting wide circulation. But it was never published by Columbia Journalism Review, and I suspect that maybe somebody was hesitant as to how some people at the New York Times might react. So I sent it to the Times, and I got a response from Joseph Lelieveld, who was the managing editor at that time, and he conceded that, yes, you found some ugly, crude language during the course of your research. But at that time, I also made a proposal to write an op-ed for the Times so that this part of its history could be addressed and known to the public. But that proposal was not accepted. So to cut the story short, it's been a challenge publishing it for a long time. At one point, I completed it in a book form and self-published. And now last year, I got a publishing contract with Kendall Hunt Publishing Company. And the book was finally published in June of this year.
I just want to step back for people and provide just a little bit of context, because I think in this day and age, it's sort of hard to understand how dominant the New York Times was in setting a narrative. I mean, you're talking about the correspondence you're talking about with Bigart is in 1959. There's no internet. There's right. I mean, there are the International Herald Tribune is overseas at that point, but that's more or less printed by, I think, an extension of the New York Times, or maybe at that point they hadn't sort of combined yet. But the New York Times, in terms of setting the narrative for a place, you know, that is, well, for really anywhere, frankly, at that point, yes. So dominant. I don't think that we can really fully grasp. If you've grown up, if you're under the age of, I don't know, of like 30 or 40 at this point, like, I don't know if you can fully grasp the what that meant. That was really it. There was no other, everything else, every other picture that you could get about Africa from in this country would have in some way emanated from the New York Times. And
absolutely,
this guy's writing about it with the, was indicative, was certainly consistent with the way that his perspective was on it. And, you know, I don't
yes.
know.
Yes, absolutely. And to make matters worse, I think the foreign editor, news editor, became so accustomed and was actually pleased by this narrative that occasionally they took matters into their own hands. Even after he was foreign news editor for about 16 years, I believe, until 1965. And then afterwards, that same MO actually continued at the Times. So I found a letter from a correspondent who had been based in Nigeria, Lloyd Garrison. He's a descendant of the famous abolitionist, William Lloyd Garrison. And he wrote complaining to the foreign news desk why an incident involving Nigerians dressed in grass leaves had been inserted into his story that he wrote from Nigeria without his knowledge. So he didn't even know about it till he read the published version of his article. And he said, obviously, this is offensive. Africans know what it means when you keep referring to them as tribesmen and tribes. He said, please never use tribesmen. If you insist, then perhaps you should use tribe, but otherwise don't. You wouldn't use that to refer to people in Belgium, for example. So that's what he was saying in his letter. And later on, I got to meet him, actually. By that time in the 90s, he was the, I think, director of communication of the Ford Foundation. So he was really elated that my research had revived something that had really bothered him while he was a New York Times correspondent. He's since passed away. Many of the people that I spoke to passed away now.
It's also fascinating, we should say, that even as late as or as recently as 92, right? I mean, we're talking 30 some odd years later, there's such fear of the New York Times in the early 90s, the power of it. I mean, one could imagine that you get a better sense of the power of a narrative in defining an entire continent in such a, you know, both offensive, but, you know, sort of a just like a, I don't know, a rudimentary, one-dimensional way. You get a sense of the power of that narrative when you realize just how powerful the New York Times was 30 years later, that nobody would publish your piece. And you went to, and this wasn't right. This wasn't just a Columbia Journalism Review. You went to a series of places, including like Mother Jones magazine, like nobody would do.
Correct. In fact, I was referred to Mother Jones by the editor at the New Yorker magazine at that time, who sent me the typical form letter, the rejection, but on the letter had a handwritten note saying, you know, something like, send this to Mother Jones, they may publish it. And of course, Mother Jones also rejected it. So it was at that point that I said, I mean, even the Village Voice won't publish it. So I said to myself, I had a friend actually that worked at the Village Voice. And he said, you know, I like the New York Times. I said, that's not the point. I mean, what is the point of being a journalist if you have to self-censor for certain media institutions and not for others? It means you're not a real journalist now. In fact, that is why I approached the Times and said, let me write an op-ed. This is a part of your history that you need to address. Instead, I think they chose the wrong course to try to ignore it as if this story would eventually just go away. And now, lo and behold, 30 years later, we find ourselves in this national and international conversation over race and the narratives of the past.
Was so much of this, you know, due to this maybe religious adherence to the New York Times, as Sam was saying, as like the bastion of truth? Like a lot of these rejections that you're seeing, one, of course, it's informed by racial undertones and biases. But two, I just would imagine like it's almost like questioning God for some,
yes.
some of these journalists. Was that a bit of the dynamic you saw?
Yes, I believe so. Because when I asked the editor of the Columbia Journalism, I said, so what was the reason for withdrawing the offer to publish? And the editor at the time, I believe it was Michael Hoyt was his name, told me that there was a belief that these things happened a long time ago. I said, well, how do you write about history without going back a long time ago and showing it's perhaps some of the continuity today? And I really then got to know that there must have been a fear of the New York Times, because I got a copy of the edited version that they edited. It was written in galley form. And you know, back in the day, how they used to do it. And they, and again, I'm paraphrasing, they inserted a passage on my behalf in the introduction saying something like, the New York Times recently allowed me access into its archives. The following essay is in no way an indictment of the New York Times. This is just to show how any media organization can go off course or something like that. So that to me was the confirmation that this was the reason why.
All right, let me just clarify. So the Columbia Journalism Review was inclined to publish this. They went so far as to edit it.
Including
in that edit was a sort of a disclaimer, like, this isn't really a criticism.
Exactly.
It's just sort of like more of a criticism of, like, boy, the world is a tough place. And
there you go.
And then even then, it became too scary for them to publish that.
Absolutely.
The book, just to be clear, is an updated, is expanded out from the Times.
Yes.
But I do think that, like, that people can see just sort of how dominant the Times was at that time for creating this narrative. And that's essentially, as society grows up, sort of having a certain perception, it's not like we're so full of information that comes from the continent of Africa now that we're like, well, that we no longer have those misperceptions.
Right.
And I should just say one more thing about that New Yorker letter, which I also find fascinating. In that day and age, too, you handwrite on something that has been filed and typed. That handwritten part, there's one carbon copy, because we didn't have, I guess by 90s,
right,
copy machines, but that goes out. There's really no record of that, because it's not like scanners proliferated where, like, you could scan that,
right,
put that on Twitter. It didn't, it just wasn't, that was just their way of saying, like, I'm with you on this, but I don't want anybody to know.
Right.
And so, all right. Well, so with that in mind, let's talk about, what's happening in Ethiopia, because I think there is a, there's just a dearth of information. Just to go back and give us a little bit of history, because I think to understand what's happening with the with Tigray, which is a region within Ethiopia, we have to go back really over the past like a couple of decades to understand where the Tigrayans were within the Ethiopian government. And
correct.
I mean, as we start to talk about Eritrea, it's fascinating to me that where Eritrea is in the context of this.
Correct.
But and people should also know Ethiopia is the second most populous country in on the continent of Africa. I mean, there's 110 million people, I believe. So, that's some of the history so that people understand the context of what's going on.
Okay, there's a lot of history, so let me see how best to summarize in the time frame we have. So many Americans would know Ethiopia through Emperor Selassie, who was the emperor for a very long time, from 1930 to 1974. I believe he might have been the 80th monarch, because Ethiopia has a long history of monarchies and a long feudal system. So he was ultimately overthrown in 1974 by the military. And out of that coup d'etat, he believed to have also been suffocated to death in 1975 by the army. And I don't think they even know up to date where his body was buried. So anyway, The junta that took over was led by a Colonel Mengistu, Haile Mariam. And he was in power until 1991. But at that time, he was meeting a lot of armed resistance from primarily coming from organized primarily from the Tigray zone, but involved Ethiopians from other parts of the country as well. And it also involved Eritreans, because Eritrea was still a part of Ethiopia at that time, but they wanted their independence. They wanted to secede. And they thought their best chance was to fight for the people that are getting rid of the military regime in Ethiopia. So they fought alongside the TPLF, and they were called the Eritrean People's Liberation Force. So they were in alliance fighting against the military dictatorship, and they ultimately overthrew the dictatorship in 1991, and that's when Eritrea also announced its independence under the President Isaias Afwerki, who has been president since then up today. And the TPLF, even though they come from Tigray, which makes up only about 7% of the population of 110 million, they became the dominant political players because they have the dominant armed force. So they invited the other regions to also join in this ruling coalition, which was nevertheless still dominated by the TPLF. And that coalition, led by a charismatic prime minister, Meles Zenawi, was pretty much intact until Zenawi died in 2012. So what we're seeing in Ethiopia today is sort of a power struggle to see who lands on its feet for the longest time since the passing of Meles Zenawi. So after Zenawi, there's been two prime ministers in succession between 2012, when he passed away, in 2018, and the country became increasingly more unstable because the Oromo people, one of the states as well, one of the regions rather, had been protesting that even though we make up the majority population, we've been marginalized when it comes to the power in the government. And that protest gained momentum. It became like a national protest. So the TPLF decided that we need to do something to defuse this. So they invited Abiy Ahmed, who is Oromo, to become prime minister. And they saw him sort of as a caretaker, you know, prime minister, because they knew elections were upcoming. And they thought, you know, well, he probably will not be the prime minister after the elections. But of course, Abiy had his own ideas that this is my chance to consolidate myself. And he negotiated the end of that war with Eritrea. Ethiopia and Eritrea had fought in 1998 to 2000, and they never signed a peace treaty. So it was in a stalemate. So he reached out and he went to Eritrea and they concluded that war, but they never publicized the details of how they resolved this crisis. Now, in retrospect, people are saying that perhaps he was actually making a deal with Afwerki, the president of Eritrea, that at one point I have to neutralize the power of the TPLF and I'm going to need your help. So that pretty much is what has unfolded since. He announced the invasion of Tigray on November 4th, 2020. He said this was an attempt to reel in a rebellious region, because by that time, Tigray had also held regional elections, even though Abiy, as the federal prime minister, had postponed national elections. He said it's because of the COVID pandemic. But in defiance, Tigray held its own elections. So then the prime minister said, well, this is an act of rebellion. And that gave him the motivation to send in the federal army. And also at the same time, Eritrea invaded Tigray from its northern border.
Well, Milton, is this simply a function of just sheer politics? I mean, where are the resources? Where do resources come into this? I mean, I know that without Eritrea, Ethiopia, as far as I can tell, is largely landlocked, right?
Absolutely. Yes.
And the only, my understanding is that the only sort of, well, at least one of the primary mechanisms to ship goods in and out of Ethiopia is through Djibouti. Yes. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. But
yes, you are.
And so where does it, how does this all play in? I mean, I have to say that, like, I think it was maybe 25 years ago, I was in Ethiopia and was a taxi driver. At that time, there was the war with Eritrea. And yes. The taxi driver basically said it was like two bald men fighting over a comb, that there really wasn't that much. they were fighting over that was really interesting. Yes. Helping them. Are we still dealing with a situation like that?
Yes, it was a barren piece of land that they fought over with no resources at all, but just happened to be geographic area on the land. And it led to the deaths of tens of thousands of soldiers on both sides. But yes, at the same time, one of the, and this of course is just talk, because nobody knows what was signed in that deal between Abiy and Afwerki. People believe that they might have reached some sort of accommodation where Ethiopia will have access to Eritrea. And there's even been some talks about perhaps Eritrea joining in the Federation with Abiy sharing the leadership of this newly federated country with Afwerki. And many people believe that Afwerki is a very cunning guy, and they believe that it essentially would be like Abiy riding on the back of the tiger, and that Afwerki at the end of the day could end up on top and actually sidelining him. So there's a lot of permutations going on. But as things stand right now, I think the pressure is now on Ethiopia, the federal government, because now Tigray is able to cast itself in this David and Goliath type narrative and see we've withstood the might of the federal army and we've withstood the might of another country invading us from the rear. And still we are here. Not only are we here, we've actually reversed the situation militarily on the ground, forcing Abiy to belatedly announce a withdrawal. Although the Tigrayans are able to display thousands of captured Ethiopian soldiers. So the pressure really is on the federal government right now. He's in a bind. Abiy cannot seem to look like he was defeated militarily. I think his officers would not tolerate that. So that would make his own tenure very precarious. And the same thing goes for Eritrea, the leadership. The guy's been there since 1991. There's a lot of dissent, and his army could become now, rather than the instrument that keeps it in power, it could become the most dangerous force if it's seen that, in fact, they were defeated by Tigray.
So, what is the situation now with, I mean, Ethiopia was, in some respects, my understanding is basically blockading Tigray. And what is the situation now in terms of, like, people's ability to eat there or get...
It's very dire. I mean, according to the United Nations, as many as 350,000 people face famine. And the numbers could, of course, be higher because an estimated 2 million people were displaced from the land out of a population of about 7 million. People stopped farming. They were not producing. And in fact, the Eritrean soldiers accused of indiscriminately destroying crops as well, just as a punitive thing. They've been reportedly the most vicious in terms of attacking civilians in this conflict, the Eritreans. And part of it is because there's an element of revenge as well. Because when Eritrea lost the war between Ethiopia and Eritrea in 1998 to 2000, most of the soldiers, the most effective fighters in the Ethiopian army came from Tigray. So there's an element of, you know, payback in what they're doing to the civilian population in Tigray.
Are there any resources that are at play here? Like, I'm just trying to understand the motivations outside of
not so much comparable to, let's say, the conflict in Eastern Congo, where you know you have this rich resource-wise Eastern Congo. So you have all these players. You had Uganda invading. You had Rwanda invading, supported by multinational corporations who were mining resources as the conflict was going on in Eastern Congo. But it's not the similar type narrative in Ethiopia. The only other big issue in Ethiopia, of course, was this big dam, this grand Ethiopian dam that they built, and now they're filling it up. And at that time, it was leading to a conflict with Egypt, because Egypt, of course, is concerned that once the dam is filled, it will affect the flow of the Nile and severely impact Egypt's agricultural production. In fact, the biggest talk before this whole conflict started was, might Egypt and Ethiopia go to war? And that has not receded, because the dam has now been filled and Egypt continues to protest. So some people believe that perhaps Egypt was also playing a role in promoting the conflict by encouraging Tigray to take up arms. So that is the other major outside factor playing into this situation.
Is there any prospect for some type of brokered peace? Or, I mean,
I think so. I think so. The African Union is taking a much more aggressive position now in insisting for a dialogue. The United States had been insisting on a negotiated outcome as well, and the UN. But I think between November and maybe June, the response was a bit was not as vigorous coming from the United States and the UN. Because I think they really did believe Abiy when he said this was going to be a swift operation and I'm going to be able to rein in this rebellious region and that would be it. Of course, it didn't turn out that way. When you unleash war, things never turn out the way that people anticipate. This humanitarian disaster has been created. The U.S. could no longer ignore that. And then, of course, once the tide changed militarily on the ground, then, of course, this is a whole new ball game. Clearly, it's clear that this can be no military solution. And I think that's why now we're seeing more aggressive push for a negotiated settlement.
Are there any U.S. interests? I mean, there is. I mean, I would maybe it's a bit of a bank shot with Egypt. But I mean, are there any direct U.S. interests there? I mean, where is China? Doesn't China have a huge investment in Ethiopia?
Yes, of course. China is one of the biggest investors now in Ethiopia. China has actually built much of Ethiopia's infrastructure, the bridges, the roads, the massive buildings. Ethiopia, in fact, was a hopeful story out of, you know, many unhopeful stories from Africa in the last couple of decades. By Western bourgeois standards, it was doing well, the economy growing at 6-7% per year, although we know in a lot of cases these stats are meaningless if it does not translate to the grassroots. But nevertheless, compared to other African countries, doing pretty well. And the U.S., of course, was not happy that Ethiopia has developed this stronger relationship with China. If China is going to offer loans and build these infrastructure, why would Ethiopia refuse that? Right. Yes, there was a lot of pressure on the Ethiopians to turn more toward the U.S. rather than China. In fact, as a result, the IMF and World Bank had offered significant financing to Ethiopia last year as a result of that pressure.
And so the U.S. is looking to at least promote some measure of stability and peace and preferably with Ahmed's government.
Absolutely. Preferably with Ahmed's government and with Ahmed on the U.S. Side, of course, away from China. Steering Ethiopia away from China with IMF and World Bank loans obviously the war was unanticipated. And that is why I think the U.S. was reluctantly to come out hard against Ahmed initially, Abiy Ahmed. But now as a result of the humanitarian crisis, it cannot be ignored. So it has to take a much more even-handed approach now in resolving this crisis.
Well, hopefully there'll be some resolution soon, because it sounds like there's hundreds of thousands of lives in the balance.
Absolutely.
Great. Well, Milton Al-Mahdi, the book is Manufacturing Hate, How Africa Was Demonized in the Western Media. We will put a link to that at majority.fm. It's fascinating stuff. Much appreciated. Thank you for coming on today.
Thank you. Thank you to both you and Emma.
Thanks.
Be well. Enjoy the rest of the day.
Thank you. All right, folks. Going to take a quick break. We come back. We will wrap things up for this first half of the program. All right, folks, that's it for us. If you are watching us on Peacock, we will say not adieu. What is it again?
Au revoir.
Au revoir. Au revoir. Thank you.
I know, but one would think that maybe you just should stop attempting it.
In French?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, well, yeah, I don't give up so easy. I'm not going to. That's not.
But you also don't try at all to learn what the right.
It's not like you're doing Duolingo every night. Yeah.
Exactly. I have a nice mix of total refusal to give in, and also total refusal to actually sort of like win.
Right.
So that's the
to do what it takes.
Yeah. Exactly.
To do what's necessary to win.
Yes. So folks should really check out Manufacturing Hate. It's fascinating, and I cannot state enough how dominant something that the New York Times had decided was reality was the reality for so many decades. But if you're watching us on Peacock, we will say see you tomorrow. And for those of you who are still here, bonne chance.
Good luck.
Yes, good luck.
Good luck. You got to deal with us for the next
Vous
hour
avez
and a half.
Bonne chance. You have good luck as we continue.
By the way, as Sam tries to figure out what French he wants to deploy, Milton has a Patreon too, the African History Club podcast that has 99 patrons. So somebody I would have thought was
going to be a number 100.
Yeah, but yeah, he does very good. I mean, he does a lot of great content, just super knowledgeable guy.
Check that out. We will put a link to that as well in the podcast and YouTube descriptions. Folks, speaking of subscriptions, I have an idea for you that is completely free.
Whoa.
It is our AM Quickie newsletter. You can head over to majority.fm, sign up, scroll down to the bottom of the page, sign up for it. And every morning, you will get an email from either Jack or Corey, who are giving you stories that you might want to know for the advance of the day. Stories sometimes that we don't even cover on the show, because there's a lot of news out there. They find stuff that you may be interested in, but you won't necessarily hear. And it is all free. You don't seem terribly impressed by that.
Did I just hypnotize you?
Yeah, that was mesmerizing, that the idea of all free.
Yeah.
Check it out. Head to majority.fm. And also, you can support this show.
Like the stream, poggers, bing, bing.
Like the stream, give us a thumbs up, make a comment, YouTube poggers, become a subscriber on Twitch.
The bing was like you doing each action, right?
Yep, bing, 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 bing.
Subscribe,
bing.
Like, bing.
And you can also support the whole show by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you support the free show and you get extra content. So there you go. Check it out. Don't forget, Nomi Show on Wednesdays and Fridays, youtube.com/TheNomiKiShow. And Matt, what's happening in the Matt Leckian universe of media?
So as you mentioned, Corey Pine of the AM Quickie, we had him on for a patron-only show for Left Reckoning this weekend. We talked about UFOs. He's a little bit more into the UFO stuff than I am, but we joined together to bash the skeptic community response, which we both think is sort of lazy rehashings of 90s arguments and sort of incurious about what's going on in the sort of deep state. Like, why are we having this discussion about UFOs?
But why are we?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, there could be, there are things out there that are being sensed that we don't really know what they are, apparently. It could be, you know, in either interstate rivalry, it could be Chinese, for instance, or it could be Navy has something they don't want to tell anyone, or a sort of maybe Blackwater has some new technology and they're buzzing ships and stuff like that.
Right.
Or it could be aliens. So we talk about that, and we also talk about another alien, Peter Thiel, what he's doing with J.D. Vance and the candidates he's supporting, as well as should we be more concerned about right-wingers being entrapped by the police or coordinating with them? So we talk about a wide range of topics. That's patreon.com/leftreckoning to get that conversation.
Sounds really good. Interesting.
It's really good, and also Corey has a big bushy beard now. That kind of I thought like my pandemic hirsuteness was
say again.
Well, hirsute about hairiness, right?
Okay.
I thought my pandemic hairiness was unchallenged, but Corey's got a big bushy beard that looks like the.
Oh, just because your hair's long now?
Yeah, I got a really long hair, and I'm also doing more of. Well, I guess I was doing the mustache before, but
yeah, you were rocking the mustache.
I think
before.
Of hairiness in terms of facial hair and other areas, not really like head.
I also
hair
have hairy
length.
Legs, so
you've well, let your hair. You've let your.
Well, no, those have always been hairy. That's not. A
this is all fun either. Half stuff.
Yeah,
I can't even believe we're giving away this content for free.
He's got hairy legs,
folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Danner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See, white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back. Back, back, back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan. By the way, it's my birthday. Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on. To pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.